This is the October 8th, 2015 environmental law class. We are wrapping up the Clean Air Act, which should be cause for relief and celebration for all of you. I can assure you that as far as complexity and Byzantine rules and regulations and truly wonkish depths of regulatory analysis, the Clean Air Act is unmatched. RCRA, we will get a little bit into the same spirit, but we will be leaving some of the more taxing portions of this class behind once we wrap up today and start moving on to climate change law, Superfund, and hazardous waste law. So with that in mind, let's look back at some of our discussion we had on Tuesday. We talked in particular about how we translate ambient air quality standards into permits under various programs of Title I. And we had our long recipe list of acronyms. So remember the acronyms because, in a way, they're a roadmap to understand the concepts of Title I. Remember, we talked about old versus new. New is new source performance standards. That applies to if you're building a new facility or significantly modifying an existing one. And they set BDT, best demonstrable technology. For old facilities or existing facilities, facilities that are in basically not new, that's probably the best way to put it. The next question becomes where? And we talked about whether or not it's an air that meets the ambient air quality standard, in which case it falls under the PSD program, Prevention of Significant Deterioration. If it's an area where the air is already dirty and doesn't meet the standard, it has to meet a much tougher regime that is called Non-Attainment New Source Review, NSR. And under each of those, you have different standards to comply with. For PSD, we're looking at BACT, Best Available Control Technologies. For Non-Attainment New Source Review, we're looking at Lowest Achievable Emission Rate, LAER, which is sort of the gorilla of Title I. It's the hardest, toughest standard to meet. The idea is that you have to have the permit to build and operate your facility under one of these programs. If you're under the Non-Attainment New Source Review, you have various requirements that apply, particularly targeting the pollutants that are out of attainment for your area. So your LAER focuses on NOx or VOCs that create ozone. Those standards have to be met, and sometimes to even begin your operation that you need the permit for, you have to get what are called offsets, which I'll come back to in a second. For PSDs, different story. PSD is an area where you're meeting the standard. You have to meet BACT, but BACT applies to all regulated pollutants. It's not just the one or two that the area is out of attainment with. So BACT's not as hard, PSD's not as hard, but it's broader. NSR, New Source Review, is narrow but tougher. All clear so far? Okay. Remember, silence is consent in this class. Then, last concept to review for everybody. We talked about the different varieties of essentially swapping emissions. Bubbling is sort of the generic broad description of the idea that you can essentially, instead of looking emission point by emission point, vent by vent, chimney by chimney, instead you can construct a bubble, an imaginary bubble of an entire facility, and all you care about is the total from the whole facility. You don't care which units are emitting which how much, as long as you get the total amount down. That was the concept upheld in the famous case we've all heard about innumerable times, Chevron versus Natural Resource Defense Council. It's not only an ad law case, it's also a legislative interpretation case, but it's also a foundational environmental case. Now, varieties of bubbling that we care about. Offsets. Offsets apply if you have a facility that you want to construct in a non-attainment area, and you have to basically take pollutants out of the air to make space for your facility. So your offsets can come from anywhere inside that polluted airshed. Depending on how polluted the air is, you may have to offset more than 1-to-1. In Houston, for example, we have to have 1.3 tons of NOx taken out in offsets if you want to add a new ton of NOx. That's different than netting. Netting determines whether or not the program applies to you in the first place. If you want to build or add a pollutant from your facility, and you're worried it's going to trigger New Source Review or PSD, What you can do is determine whether or not you have other emissions that are being reduced at your facility that can basically net out with the new additional pollutants you're adding. That is within the fence line, or at most with another facility you own right nearby. The idea is that if you want to stay below 100 tons per year, and your adding is going to be 120, but you can find another unit you've shut down in that space of the year before that's 50 tons, do the math. You end up with 80 tons net that nets you out of the threshold. All clear so far? So netting offsets similar in spirit, all within the grand idea of bubbling, but they do different things within the Clean Air Act. Okay. And by the way, I'm very serious. Any questions about this, please ask. There are people who practice this field of law for a long time who get wrapped around the axle all the time with it. So there's absolutely total license to ask questions about this sort of stuff. We also talked about air toxics, Title III. And remember, that discussion included things such as the fact that it's under 112R. The idea is that there are 189 statutory hazardous air pollutants that they apply to industrial categories. And within each of those categories, EPA, by the statute, must set a standard that is based on the top 12% performers within that category. That becomes the floor. That standard is called Maximum Achievable Control Technology, otherwise known as MACT. And it doesn't get any tougher under any program of the Clean Air Act. MACT is tougher than LAIR. MACT is the tightest emission standard. And MACT is a moving target because it's based on practices adopted by the industry sector. And as they get better, MACT in theory gets better too. Now, assume you do MACT. Well, is that still good enough? You're basing on the 12% of the industry does. That doesn't necessarily mean that you want to be standing at the fence line breathing it. Well, EPA then does what's called a residual risk analysis. They look at what the endpoint is once you've done MACT. And if it still has enough air toxins to exceed a statutory threshold of 1 in 1 million cases of cancer, that is enough to require further reductions past MACT. And they're required to do this residual risk analysis every 5 years. Well, and it's not just paperwork. We just did one for refineries, and I can tell you right now there's a litigation firestorm of gargantuan proportions building up.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So the way I see it, let's just say that EPA says, okay, you have to do like a 10% reduction, and you have like four smoke stacks in place. That means that like instead of taking like, I don't know, one from each, like putting it down one, you would take four from one of them, at least sufficient one, and that'd be okay under the EPA, correct?
Right. That's the concept generally of bubbling. You're absolutely correct.
So, but then what's the difference between that and netting? I don't understand.
Well, netting applies in a specific situation where you are doing something that might trigger either the new source review program or PSD program. And that threshold is based on the number of tons per year of the pollutant that this new unit's going to add. Well, that total threshold number can be pushed down if you've reduced emissions somewhere else in your facility. So it sounds like bubbling. The idea is that netting is dedicated to whether or not you can net out of the program by pushing your emissions down below that statutory threshold. For example, this is probably not for the final. This is just in case you guys run across it talking with someone in the field. But suppose you have a facility which, if you run it according to the nameplate capacity, remember we talked the potential to emit, it's going to exceed the threshold. Well, what if you say, cross my heart, promise I will never, ever, ever run it more than 50%. If you enter into an order that's binding and enforceable, you essentially make this facility that would be a major facility into an artificial minor facility. It's called a synthetic minor. That's sort of the idea. If you can control the emissions down below that threshold, you basically sidestep the program. You have to meet other requirements. It's not a free pass, but it's not triggering PSD or NSR. So does that help? I'm not sure I can repeat it. I can say it again, and hopefully it'll match up fairly closely. For older facilities, if you're not an NSPS facility, The question is whether it's going to be in an attainment area or non-attainment area. So that facility is going to have to either meet PSD for an attainment area, prevention of significant deterioration, or it's going to have to meet non-attainment new source review. And that's just usually called NSR. Does that help? And then the technology standards for PSD, it's BAT, best available control technology. For non-attainment new source review, it's LAIR, lowest achievable mission rate. Okay. Any others? These are all good questions. Okay, so with that in mind, our final lap of the Clean Air Act. What I'd like to cover today is let's go back and pick up acid rain, which means we'll talk about how Title IV of the statute works. And what that really means is we're going to talk about markets, trading, achieving commission standards by not passing any kind of specific standard, but simply saying, here's the total, you get there however you want to, but you've got to buy the right to emit every ton you emit. And we're going to make sure the total amount gets capped and reduced. We're also going to talk a little bit about the one case in that Title IV discussion, which is the Alliance for Clean Coal versus Buy decision. And that's really more an interesting case in terms of whether or not states can favor homegrown energy, which is relevant for other reasons. And then we'll wrap up with probably the most complicated part of the Clean Air Act, what a better way to wrap it up, multi-state air pollution. And that should be more than enough for one day. Okay? So with that, let's turn to Title IV, acid rain. And this, in some ways, is one of the most innovative, it's one of the older, and it's also one of the most effective of all the parts of the Clean Air Act. Title IV essentially controls a relatively narrow universe of facilities that emit sulfur dioxide. Remember in our intro to clean air, I talked about the fact that sulfur dioxide, when it's emitted into the air, can travel significant distances. It reacts with water droplets and clouds and makes them acidic, basically mild sulfuric acid. And that this acid rain phenomenon had been responsible for widespread damage to forests and acidification of streams along the East Coast. And this has been a problem that had been building up since the early 1970s. So the idea with Title IV is they knew where to go. There is basically a small number of large coal-fired utilities that were creating acid rain. So these 111 big dirties, quote unquote, were essentially all large units with giant stacks, more than 500 foot tall, chimneys, that emitted the sulfur dioxide into the air. Now, with that in mind, what the EPA did was Congress could have said, meet LAIR, meet BAT. We're going to create some other new acronym you have to meet. They didn't. Instead, the idea is that they created the first cap and trade system. It's an easy universe to monitor. Every one of these smokestacks has a detection unit telling you exactly what they're emitting, how much, when. And they're relatively easy to target because they are required to report what they emit, and you can come at them when they exceed it. So as a result, we now have in here, hopefully this is familiar, so we won't go into great detail, essentially an annual budget of how much SO2 can be emitted by all of these units. The way this budget works is essentially those big dirties are given what's called an allowance, which equals 1 ton per year of sulfur dioxide. And they have to buy enough allowances to cover all of their emissions. Now, the initial allocation of these allowances, well, normally, remember I would say maybe an auction is the best free market way to do it. You sort of get an efficient outcome at the very start. No. For many reasons, including political ones. Congress decided that they were going to provide for allocations based on historical usage. So the ones who've been emitting the most sulfur dioxide initially got the most allowances. But the idea was that as time went by, the global cap for all these units would start going down. And each of these units could therefore, if they reduced more than they needed for their emissions, they had more allowances than they needed, they could sell their excess. Through the alchemy and the magic of the free market, what that meant was efficient units that could reduce cheaply, built up stockpiles of allowances, and then made a profit off of them by selling to the other older inefficient units that couldn't reduce their emissions. The older units incurred a financial headwind, a penalty that sort of encouraged them that they are going to have to either figure out some way to reduce their emissions efficiently or go out of business. The newer, more efficient units are able to essentially reap the benefits of their efficiencies. Essentially, the invisible hand is the regulator. It was incredibly effective. Most studies have shown that it achieved results for anywhere from half or less of the cost of what it would have taken to create a usual permit rule regulatory system, and that it achieved results very quickly. The program has been since extended and now includes not just the big dirties, but also a large universe of what are called phase two electrical generator units that also burn coal and that also generate sulfur dioxide. In addition, there's an opt-in for people who are exempt from the program who still nonetheless want to get in. And I'll just sort of pause for a moment. Why on earth would you opt to get into a program regulated by EPA in this sort of circumstance?
You join in the marketplace and your efficiency suddenly becomes a profit.
Right, money. You're absolutely correct. To a certain extent, if you can reduce your SO2 in a way that generates a creditable allowance, you have a strong financial incentive to essentially subject yourself to voluntary regulation and become part of the market, which normally extending these kinds of programs is an enormously difficult task. So here's one drawback. One of the most effective, efficient, and cheap ways to reduce your sulfur dioxide emissions is not to control what's coming out your stack by putting a giant scrubber on top. Instead, it's just to buy a different kind of coal. It turns out coal from the Appalachian markets tends to have a higher amount of sulfur in it, which leads to higher amounts of sulfur dioxide. If you instead go to other areas, in particular the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, the coal there naturally has lower amounts of sulfur. So instead of putting the hardware on your stack to control sulfur dioxide emissions, you just, if the rail lines are cheap, ship your coal down, and you get your SO2 down that way. Well, that works great for the power generators. It may work great in terms of air quality upwind, but it was devastating for the power market for Appalachian coal miners and other markets, in particular Illinois, Indiana, that also relied on high sulfur coal. So that kind of led to a natural incentive. Remember, who sets electrical prices in most states, like in Texas, for example? Just, you should all know, this wasn't in our reading, but just offhand. Is it the TCEQ? Does they dictate electrical prices, electricity prices? Well, the retailers are private, but the wholesale rates are set. One state agency keeps gouging from happening and sets a sort of baseline rate. Which one is it typically?
PUC,
the Public Utility Commission, which oftentimes is elected government officials. Well, it turns out if you're, say, in a certain state and your utility has a choice of using your state's coal, which happens to be high in sulfur, or someone else's coal that happens to be low in sulfur, well, as a member of the PUC, isn't there sort of a natural temptation here to say, thou shalt burn coal from the home mines? Now, that sort of leads us to our case, first case for today, which leads me now to, who is our first victim?
Xenia Chan.
Oh, okay. Although I think you've kind of drawn the short straw already this class, and she's not on the opt-out list. Of course. Peter, you can always ask a question. You know that.
Why is the SO2 production or the limit per plant? You said it was a ton.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when these plants obviously are producing thousands and thousands of tons, why do they even set it in ton? Why don't they just say, you've got to buy it? Is there a reason it's set as a ton? Because it's,
what would be an alternative unit that'd be bigger?
Nothing.
Pounds?
No, just, you know, if you're going to produce SO2, you need to buy credits, or you need to bank, or you need to do something else.
But the credit must be keyed to some physical quantity, otherwise it's divorced from any real-world effect.
So it's a place marker, is essentially what they're doing.
Right. I mean, it could have been, if you're really emitting, megatons. It could be in pounds. And, you know, some trading programs, they actually trade in grams.
So they're just tying it to something.
Right. It's tied to some physical marker of the actual quantity be emitting in the real world.
Okay.
So Cynthia, you've now had an additional 30 seconds of grace to take a look, but we're looking particularly at the case, the only case in Title IV, the Alliance for Clean Coal versus BI. And I was wondering if you could start by getting the whole class in the discussion by giving us a picture as to what was involved in the case. What were they fighting over? Mm-hmm.
So,
so thou shalt buy from the home mine, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the power plants argued that I guess it's unconstitutional.
Why? What ground? I don't recall a home mining clause in the Constitution.
Well, it has to do with the interstate commerce clause.
Mm-hmm. Professor Turner's watching you right now. What, do you remember what he talked about in terms of Commerce Clause jurisdiction?
No, not a lot.
Oh, don't tell him that. I should have turned off the recorder before you answered. Okay, so of the Commerce Clause, what aspect of Commerce Clause jurisprudence deals with situations where a state is trying to basically favor its home commerce over another? I mean, put it this way. Did Congress pass a law saying states can't do this? There's no federal statute here. Does the Commerce Clause specifically say states can't do this? Well, in a way it does, but hey, bottom line here is the dormant Commerce Clause. Does that sort of bring back memories?
Yes, but we skipped that
section. Really? Y'all skipped the dormant Commerce Clause?
No.
I'm sorry? Your section too? Well, I must say that hurts a little bit. All right, let me just sort of simply say. The Dormant Commerce Clause deals with situations where a state is doing either of two things. One, they overtly, explicitly, and expressly discriminate against out-of-state commerce. So, in that situation, they say, you must buy local, in which case, under the Commerce Clause doctrine, the Commerce Clause jurisprudence, the courts will use strict scrutiny to determine whether or not that state's statute meets a rational purpose, or a compelling state interest, excuse me, that's a more correct term. If it doesn't, if it just happens to have the collateral effect of disfavoring out-of-state commerce, a different standard applies, and it's a gentler one, that essentially measures the burden that that regulation places on interstate commerce and then weighs whether or not that burden outweighs the local benefits. So it's a balancing test. It's called the Pike Church test, which I think the case we're talking about mentions. So given that fundamental divide in Commerce Clause cases, which side of the line is this regulation falling on? Is it explicit, overt, manifest discrimination against out-of-state commerce, or is it sort of a facially neutral rule that happens to have the effect of burdening out-of-state commerce? Really? It doesn't say anything officially about out-of-state versus local?
Oh, well, it says that you can't buy from out-of-state.
So isn't that explicit, overt, textually demonstrable discrimination? It's pointing the scarlet finger of shame at out-of-state coal and saying you can't buy it? Okay. And that was a leading question, I apologize. So, that means we have a strict scrutiny test to apply here. And now my favorite question, who won? Okay, and why did the court say the power plant gets to buy out-of-state coal and throw local workers out of employment? But that's a conclusion. That's not a rationale.
I think the court was saying, by
doing this, although it didn't affect me personally. They're saying that, you know, local workers losing their jobs is not a sufficient justification to actually.
Mm-hmm. Which sounds a little heartless.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, it gets there to kind of do-si-do two-step. First thing the strict scrutiny test does, and this applies to anything you guys are going to take a look at, is it shifts the burden of proof. The state that wants to promulgate this standard has to demonstrate why it meets the standard. They have to prove it. And here, the rationale they offered up, you know, again, did they have anything besides the fact other than just they wanted to keep workers, you know, in their jobs? Is that the sole basis?
They mentioned, keeping a low-cost retail market, which, again, is indirectly related to the jobs, I guess. They said that also was not sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it's not sufficient because of the strict scrutiny test. And this also should be a memory flashback for all of you from con law. If there's a less discriminatory method to get to the same place, the state needs to take that less burdensome pathway. And here, if you're worried about worker unemployment, if you're worried about a flexible mix of power sources, there are other ways to get there other than saying thou shalt not burn out of state coal. So this case is not really much about trading or Title IV. It's about some of the collateral consequences of it, and it's a beautiful demonstration of the limits that are imposed on states to tinker with national pollution control programs. The Dormant Commerce Clause is extremely vital and powerful and still active. It has influenced whether or not states can ban the shipment of out-of-state trash to their landfills. It has been used on whether or not states can ban the use of certain types of electricity generated across state lines from coal-fired facilities, or mandate the use of renewable energy. There is a major test dealing right now with the fact that California has mandated the use of low-carbon gasoline and fuel, which disfavors fuels generated from other states that don't have to meet that standard. Is that a dormant commerce clause violation? You'll see this come up again and again and again in environmental law programs. So for now, I just wanted to just flag this to show you the bite that this doctrine has and that it does shape how Title IV works. So do you have a question? Just thinking. Okay. All right, so let me kind of come to the final point here. The program, there is a question. You're at semi-peripheral vision, sorry.
So to clarify, the problem was not that the state interests were not legitimate. It was that it wasn't narrowly tailored to meet those interests?
That, yes, especially if there's an express textual discrimination against out-of-state commerce. Now, it'd be interesting, and I don't mean to muddy the waters, what if the state had been more adept in drafting and effectively came up with a standard that had the effect of discriminating against out-of-state coal? Then it's a balancing test. And maybe we have a different answer in terms of narrowly drawing those interests. But the state had a high burden here to prove, and you're exactly right. It wasn't that their interests are illegitimate necessarily, it was just that they hadn't tailored one that met the substantial burdens requirements of the strict scrutiny test. I thought about doing this and decided ultimately not to, but you can buy SO2 credits. The market is active, vital, in place today. It turns out one of the most active places for this type of arbitrage and trading is Houston. This here is Air and Liquid Advisors. There's another group called Element Markets. They're very, very good at essentially identifying where credits are needed and making them available and basically benefiting off the exchange prices. So if we wanted to buy a ton of SO2 today, right now in class, looks like right now, well actually this is an older data, but it's about $83 to $86 per ton. Now notice it's not just Title IV in SO2, this is also markets available under for NOx and for CO2. And we'll talk a little bit about those as well. But the idea of markets has grown past Title IV and now is a vital part of Title I for trading for NOx and ozone precursors. It's also a vital part of trading as well proposed for toxics. The Air Toxics Program essentially had a mercury trading rule for power plants. So it's worth understanding how this works. With that in mind, before we go to multi-state air pollutant trading, I would just like to sort of ask a couple of fundamental philosophical questions about markets, because they really will dictate how you think about them. There are people who believe deeply and fundamentally that this is a flawed and immoral process, that this is the wrong way to control pollution. Leaving aside the question of whether or not you can morally buy the right to pollute the air or water, let's just sort of ask a more technical question. What's a bad collateral, unexpected side effect of letting the market dictate where your emission sources are going to be? Just think creatively. If you were going to fight a program like this, what's something that you could point to as an impossible bad result?
Well, the community that's around can be affected.
How so?
Well, I drive off T25, and this seems crazy to me, because I'm on T25, and I see all these emissions coming out. And to the left, you have Pasadena High School. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. Mm-hmm. A high school right next, I mean, a highway across. And I think, I mean, I don't know what kind of issues they have in regards to health hazards or cancers in that area, but I wouldn't be surprised to see that they tend to have more issues with respiratory diseases than somewhere in North Michigan.
And I hear you. That makes perfect sense, particularly from an ethical perspective. But that doesn't address markets. How would a market make that better or worse? How about allowing trading of emissions affect that?
Well, if these oil companies or refineries are buying up more and the polluter pays principle applies, then they're not going to care about polluters around. They're just going to buy it more. And if they have great resources, well, then what's to stop them?
So essentially, if I could rephrase a little bit what you're saying, the market could allow older inefficient units to keep cranking it out if they can buy the credits from someone else. And the bottom line is, while from the big picture, pollution may go down, in that neighborhood, pollution stays where it's at or gets worse. And if you think about it, one thing a market might do is consolidate pollution by allowing an inefficient producer to harvest other people's credits, clean the air in a broad area, but result in a focus point, a hot spot that the market allows to continue to operate.
I also think there's a slight argument for, say, once they force people out of the market, you might be able to force, like you said, a greener energy out of the market, or a company that's smaller. I mean, if you can go around buying old, used up plants, new company the size of Exxon, and you've got a ton of money to throw around, you can definitely monopolize and push people around with this.
Right. So to a certain extent, it may create anti-competitive effects. You're absolutely correct. One argument in favor of markets also touches on what you just said. And you said it might push green energy or newer technologies out?
Not even green energy, but the same time, yes, it might push someone that's going to build a cleaner plant on that 100%, but you're coming in, you're trying to do things that will cost more to do. You cannot use your money to buy the pollution. Mm-hmm. Allocations, and you just more, you just can't do it. Yeah, I think it would essentially push players out of the market.
Well,
smaller players.
Because my moral intuition, that's not the right word, my intuition matches yours, that it's possible if you already have a dominant market player to imagine them taking advantage of their current position to essentially dominate the emission pool. It's effectively a finite resource and elbow out new competitors before they get a chance to get started. And the reason interesting, you and I came to that same place, and by the way, that doesn't mean it's right, it's just my personal opinion. But most economists say markets actually spur innovation, that they allow entry of new players. If you can invent a new technology that cuts your emissions in half, boom, you've suddenly got this credits you can sell. But there are other professors who are just dead set who say that actually what happens is people with money tend to soak it up and push new players out of the market unless those new players have a lot of financial backing. All right, one final thought in terms of markets. One other thing about markets you may want to object to, besides the fact they may create hot spots, besides the fact they may have anti-competitive effects, besides the questions as to whether they spur innovation, two others I'll pass on to you, then we can move to multi-state air pollution trading. One, there's an interesting overlap of areas that seem to accumulate emissions and have hot spots with environmental justice communities. There are there's a strong concern that markets can have the effect of essentially allowing those with money and resources to buy and shift pollution to those who lack the money and end up living next to communities where, you know, they essentially are burdened with excess pollution because the market shifts it to their location. Environmental justice and markets is a very controversial area right now. And last, markets can be brutally unpredictable. Prices can gyrate wildly. And while, you know, as we saw with, you know, trading electricity in California and Enron, there's some risk of manipulation. It's just really base market forces and supply and demand can cause real volatility that makes it hard to plan. A couple of years ago, VOCs per ton in Houston started gyrating wildly and hit a record of $270,000 per ton. Yeah, it's hard to do your capital planning on something like that. So there's this, I don't mean to imply you're stuck. For those of you who love finance and corporate dealings, there's an entire secondary market on options and futures on emissions trading. So you can actually hedge your future risks. And the people who do this, it's just mind-bending mathematical complexity of these tools. But bottom line is that it still ultimately requires management and some real volatility. Okay, so with that, yes?
Does the state play any role in within the market itself? Is it like a market player? Does it buy and sell credits as well?
My favorite answer, yes and no. This is a national market for SO2 created by Title IV. So that is basically under federal law. States play only at most a subsidiary role. For other markets under Title I, remember, those are under state implementation plans. States can choose to have markets. And as a result, the VOC per ton cost I told you for Houston, that's under a state trading plan under state law that the state oversees. When we get to next week and talking about greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, one of the big questions facing EPA right now is whether or not to allow states to use trading to meet their greenhouse gas limits. And if so, how? Especially when you have states like some, like say, oh, Texas, who say hell no. You know, it kind of limits your trading opportunities. Okay, any other questions on Title IV, SO2 emission restrictions, cap and trade, how the markets are working?
Let me comment on the website.
Of course.
Can you scroll down? It's really funny here. They have the windmills. They have the windmills and. Okay, it was funny because they're like subtly and like they have windmills and like
there they are.
They should have like factories, you know.
The smoke. Well, the sunset's nice because of pollution.
That's true. Particulates are very artistically helpful. I'll simply say if you were to ask them, their response would be, they're helping tap the creative energy of the market to reduce pollution. And I'll just leave it at that. Okay, so with that, sort of pick up our final lap, which is going to be multi-state trading, or multi-state air pollution. And this is where the action's at these days in addition to climate change. And it really comes down to this. This is the core dynamic. In the 1970s, in 1977, when they first wrote the Clean Air Act, air pollution was a local urban problem. Almost all the air pollution we cared about was homemade. So that's why we initially created this framework we've talked about in Title I, where states come up with a plan, and each of those SIP plans focus on local emission sources and try and make sure that the ambient air quality standard for the local area, like a city, gets clean. Well, it turns out that's not the whole picture. It turns out that actually substantial portions of air pollution is actually not caused locally, but travels, migrates across state lines. And if you were to take a look, for example, there was a Texas air quality study done about 8 years ago, where they actually mapped and they could actually see ozone migrate out from Houston over to the Gulf, sit, and then migrate back in again the next day. You can actually see the plumes of ozone from Houston go up towards Dallas and curve over across Arkansas. You can also see ozone blowing in west from California towards Houston. It's a much more complicated picture. The most important part is in 1990, Congress recognized that and created specific provisions so that the local planning process built in safeguards so that states that were upwind were not causing problems for their neighbors downwind. There are a couple of provisions, the ones we care most about. The first one I've handed out to you, it's section 7410 of the Clean Air Act. It essentially requires an accounting for cross-state pollution. We'll talk about the specific language in that provision in a minute. The other one is section 126, which is essentially the good neighbor petition process. That one allows a state that thinks it's basically getting the burden of another state's pollution to go to EPA and essentially throw their neighbor under the bus. Essentially say, look, we're pretty sure that Ohio's coal-fired power plants are causing our air problems in New York. EPA, you go to Ohio and make them ratchet down. And that petition process is designed so that the states themselves create this ratcheting effect of reducing limits for what pollution sources are allowed. So that has spurred, and I'm not exaggerating, a 20-year litigation odyssey that just wrapped up in January of this year. And the beautiful part is, as I'll tell you at the end of class, it's about to ramp back up again. So with that in mind, let's take a look at the language. I just want to make sure we know what we're talking about before we turn to our first case today, which means you might want to start thinking about our next designated victim, which would be Michigan versus EPA. So 7410, what we care about is subpart 2. Each implementation plan submitted by a state under this chapter shall be adopted by the state after reasonable notice and public hearing. Each such plan shall D, contain adequate provisions, skipping down the next one, adequate provisions prohibiting consistent provisions of this subchapter, any source or other type of emissions activity within this state from emitting any air pollution and pollutant in amounts which will, and here's the core language, contribute significantly to non-attainment in or interference with maintenance by any other state with respect to any such national primary or secondary ambient air quality standard. That's it. This provision is buried in literally 100 pages of statutory text. What does it mean? Well, EPA created essentially a program where they decided that they were going to effectively target upwind states through what was called initially first a NOx SIP call, a giant rule that required 26 states to submit their SIPs to EPA with additional controls of NOx and SO2 that were causing pollution problems downwind along the east coast of the United States. That air pollution transport rule was in 1998. That NOx SIP call led to the first test of litigation as to whether or not this type of approach that EPA chose met the requirements of the Act. So with that, other than Sinha, who else have we pulled up off our stack today?
Jeff Lem.
Is Jeff here today? There you are, I'm sorry. Of course you're here today. I'm beginning to wonder about this. I've actually thought about getting like one of those bingo machines where you put the balls in and you rotate them. It might distribute it a little bit more equally. Would you like to pick the next class?
I think I would.
Okay. Fair enough. We haven't quite reached the threshold of three times in a row yet, but we're getting there. Okay. So Jeff, if you could, give us a little bit of walkthrough for the class. What's at stake in Michigan versus EPA? Yes. This is not the toxics case. This is the air transport case. I know it's confusing to have two cases at the same time. Mm-hmm. This is actually the NOx SIP call, but ultimately became the CARE plan, yes.
Okay.
And that's CARE is for everyone writing that down, that's CAIR, the Clean Air Interstate Rule. You don't need to commit that to memory because the CARE rule is finally dead. And I'll explain why that matters in a little bit.
after the EPA determined that they were contributing, those 23 states' facilities were contributing to other states' non-attainment of the NAAQS standards.
And here's one where it actually do need to sink a little bit into the weeds.
Okay.
How did EPA determine which states upwind were contributing significantly? Again, that being the significant, the core language of the statute. I'm not sure what you mean.
It was the untransport assessment group.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was thinking actually more of what actual analytical standard did EPA use.
Oh, okay.
It's a two-part test. You know, one is they figured out how much pollution ozone in a downwind state could actually be fairly attributed to that upwind state. So the threshold was 2 parts per billion. If you contributed to at least one state downwind enough to bump up their ozone levels by 2 parts per billion, which is virtually undetectable by most standard technologies. All right, scratch that. That was an editorial comment. Don't ignore that. Anyway, that's step one. And then step two is it doesn't mean everybody who's upwind who hits that standard is going to necessarily have to go all out. What's the next step of the process? And let's pause for a minute to admire the ingenuity, the almost devious cleverness of that answer. Think about EPA could have gone a different way here, couldn't they? They could have said 2 parts per billion, that's enough. You're in. You've now got to come up with a plan that is going to reduce your emissions so that that 2 part per billion bump drops. And by the way, you're going to go through the exact same SIP process you do for all your other plans, and we get to approve it. And we get to dictate to you whether or not we think that your recipe meets the standard or not. That would have been an enormous undertaking. Years and years of effort. Instead, EPA said something different. They said 2 parts per billion. And by the way, we don't care what you do. States come up with their own budget, essentially, based on an idea that $2,000 per ton is our benchmark. If you can come up with a control measure that, put it this way, we think any emissions that can be controlled for that amount or less is going to be what's, quote, contributing significantly, close quote, downwind. That's it. It's a kind of an interesting quasi-hybrid market approach, isn't it? Essentially, EPA sets what the bump is, that is set by the actual modeling and the science, and then they set what they think is a fair number for the cost per ton that each state has to sort of plan for. But then they say to the state, you choose. All we're saying is that we think of the tons that your state's emitting, you can reduce this amount for $2,000 per ton or less. Does that make sense for folks? It's that sort of two-step process? Okay, because it's worth making sure you understand it because it pops up again like a gremlin at each successive air rule, this sort of two-step process. EPA models what's upwind, comes up with which states are causing downwind problems, and then goes back to the states and essentially says, we're going to set a number that we think's the efficient number for reducing per ton. And based on that number, here's the amount of tons you have to reduce by. You figure it out from that point. Now, I'll pause here. That system sort of poses a little bit of a risk of unfairness, doesn't it? I mean, it assumes all states have an even distribution of these cheap NOx reductions. What if that's not the case? What if it turns out Texas, and I'm just speaking hypothetically, has 10 times as many cheap tons of NOx that it can control compared to Mississippi? Well, under this system, that means EPA is going to expect Texas to reduce 10 times as much compared to Mississippi, because that's where the cheap reductions are. From a global perspective, from an efficiency perspective, from an economics perspective, that may be totally, completely rational. But it's a totally different viewpoint if you're in Austin. So does that sort of set the stage a little bit for why this case mattered? And this is a $1 billion fight. To give you a sense, and this is basically not one or two states. I don't have it there. It's basically half the country. All this mid portion of the country going east was in this lawsuit. So, coming back again, my favorite question, Jeff, who won? So, and essentially, EPA won because the court found that the language contributes significantly was broad enough to allow it to incorporate cost considerations. I'll pause here. Who wants to channel Scalia for a minute for me? You look Scalia-ish today. This is an easy one. Do you see the word cost anywhere at all in that entire provision? I'm just pausing here. I think there might have been a fair point to be made that if Congress meant to say cost, they certainly said cost in other portions of the act. But here the word significant, quote unquote, was deemed to implicitly contain enough flexibility that you could consider cost. Pause for a minute. That is directly opposite what they said in Title I, isn't it? When they set NAAQS, cost can't be considered. Now all of a sudden, magically, cost can be considered. I just point out. Yep.
Actually, you're being a little unfair to Scalia, considering the context.
I'm always unfair to Scalia.
Well, I am too, but in Title I, the language was deliberately about health costs, and that's why they said you couldn't consider cost. There was about health impacts, and that's why you couldn't consider cost in that analysis. But here, just like in the later Michigan case, you have very broad language, which could encompass the cost. And that's really the distinction between Whitman and these later cases.
Well, to be a little less fair to Scalia,
sure.
This is part of Title I, the same provisions that are the NAAQS standards, so within the same section. Second, the later Michigan case you're referring to, it wasn't that the statute was broad enough that they could include cost if they wanted to. The court actually said EPA was arbitrary and capricious by not considering cost. So we're kind of moving our way along the spectrum here of NAAQS standards, you can't consider costs, to here EPA can consider costs if they so choose, because it's big enough to, by God, we're going to throw EPA out of court unless they consider cost. So anyway, I take your point. You're fair. I'm only highlighting that there seems to be a little bit of flexibility in this mode of analysis here. Oh, that really hurts. Okay. Any other thoughts or questions? All right, so I guess if I could, one final point, and this may be an unfair question, Jeff, but does this conclusion seem to you something we can reconcile with our old friend Virginia versus EPA, which said states get to pick the recipe, EPA can't dictate how? How so? Okay, if I could torture you a little bit, but that number didn't come out of the fertile imagination of the EPA administrator. It's based on an assessment of the technologies that were available. They chose one and said, that's only $2,000 a ton. We know now you can do it for $2,000 a ton. That's our number. Doesn't that essentially say you have to use that technology to get to that number?
That technology or anything better than that. So there's still some element of choice in there.
Okay. All right. And you're right. That's what the court says. It tends to make an assumption that there's a broad, rich universe of technologies to choose from. And I'll simply say that's not always the case. I mean, you may have the possibility of a what's called a selective catalytic converter, essentially a reducer. a unit that captures and converts the fumes, or certain types of low NOx burners, but there's really not a lot you can do because it's a byproduct of combustion. Anyway, you're absolutely correct. I just wanted to say that there's a sort of implicit assumption, this magic $2,000 number, that you can use any technology. There may not be a whole lot of technologies out there.
Isn't this information that the feds are using and the EPA is using to get there in the first place, information that's coming out of the SIPs of states who said this is what we can do anyway, so they're really just using, I know they're uniform across the board, but they're just using the state's information.
Partially. In addition to the SIPs, they also they'll do what's called a Section 114 information request to industry sectors and essentially create a database of technologies. They'll also go to the vendors who sell the technologies and ask them what they think. And I'm sure this will sound cynical, but you know, if you were a vendor, the possibility that EPA may make your technology a regulatory mandate is rather appealing. So it colors what vendors sometimes, and I don't mean disrespect, but sometimes they'll say things like, oh, you bet we can do that. That's absolutely practical. Our technology is guaranteed to hit that result. And you know, oftentimes vendors end up driving the standard a lot more than the industry does. Any other thoughts, comments? Okay, so Jeff's exactly right. EPA wins. The words contribute significantly contain magically enough flexibility to allow EPA to do this two-step process. They model how much each state's contributing downwind, and then they come up with a dollar number based on a technology assessment, and then let the allocation to the states be driven by that number, so that the states that have cheap NOx reductions go first. So that led, after the NOx SIP call, to the Section 126 petitions. Remember I said there were two provisions? This is 110A. 126 is the rat on your neighbor's provision. And several states essentially submitted a petition to EPA saying, we don't think this is enough. We're having trouble hitting our own zone standard by requiring reductions from our local industries. You need to go outside our borders and go upwind. That led to a full consideration, but basically the book goes into some detail. I'll simply give you the bottom punchline. EPA punted. They said, you're right, states. We agree your Section 126 petition identifies an area where we should require further reductions from other states. But you know what? We're going to kick the can down the road and defer action because we're working on the next best new thing, the Clean Air Interstate Rule, CARE. And CARE came out about a decade ago. And CARE essentially was a giant combination of a SIP call for 28 states this time for both NOx and SO2. It also included some particulates. And it essentially created the same two-step process but added a market mechanism to it. I'll be honest with you, in prior classes, we've devoted gruesome amounts of time to CARE. You guys are the lucky beneficiaries of history, because we're not. I'm going to simply tell you what has happened to CARE, because CARE has now been replaced. The bottom line with CARE is CARE was struck down by the D.C. Circuit, and predominantly on the grounds that every state was required by the Clean Air Act to reduce its emissions affecting downwind states. And a market allowed a state to essentially shift its obligations to someone else and not act itself. And that was enough for the court to strike down the entire rule. Well, EPA went back to this court immediately after and said, wait, that's chaos. Let us have CARE while we work on a new rule. And the court said, okay, we'll take back our vacating of the rule. It's now CARE's in place while you work on the new rule, but you will work expeditiously to do so. Well, how many of you remember the desegregation cases? You know, with all deliberate speed. It took a while to come up with the next version of this rule. And to be fair to EPA, it's extremely complex, especially with these multiple layers of review that are taking place. The rule that took its place, the one that's now the law of the land, the one you should care about, is the Cross-State Air Pollution Rule, affectionately referred to by its acronym CASPER. It is essentially a version of CARE, where it's the same thing. They went through the same two-step process, where they looked at upwind states, and calculated how much those upwind states were directly contributing to non-attainment of downwind states. Once they had that number, they went ahead and went back and calculated a number, again, a cost per ton number, which they used to allocate which states had to reduce pollution the most. Here's where it went a little different than CARE. This time around, EPA essentially went back and said, we're going to skip to the end and issue a federal implementation plan to apply this rule directly now. And this FIP essentially deprived the states, according to the states, of their chance to come up with their own SIP to implement the CASPER. So that gives us to our last case for the day, which means you get, you know, believe me, with only 5 or 10 minutes, we may end up bleeding a little bit to our next class on this one. It's a complicated case. But who's our next victim?
Andre Baru.
Oh. Yep, you have to compare the opt-out list. And you have the newborn exemption, I think you can apply for yourself. And that's not an incentive for anyone else to have newborns.
Richard Gardner?
Oh, I don't, is Richard, there you are. Sorry, your hat threw me off for a second.
So I left mine at home.
Well, you know, I thought that.
Well, I have Ben.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all right. Well, then how about this? If you guys will promise me that you will spend part of your free weekend time thinking about cross-state air pollution. Well, that's a sad comment. Sorry. Let's at least tee up the Homer City case. And then what I'd like to do is then sort of have people think about over the weekend to wrap it up before we move on to the greenhouse gas regulations on Tuesday. So with that in mind, you know, I've already set the stage a little bit with CASPER. What's the claim that's being raised in EME versus Homer City? If I've got the wrong case name, you're giving me a raised eyebrow. I'm sorry, I look at the wrong person.
Yeah.
No wonder you're giving me a raised eyebrow. You're thinking, you're pulling the card, so you're safe. You're sort of a safe zone. I'm sorry, Richard, go ahead. It's your suit and tie threw me off.
What page is that on?
No, no, there's two. There's the book has the DC Circuit decision, which is a very redacted version of it. Then there's the actual website has the full Supreme Court decision from 2013. And as a matter of fact, at least I hope I've got it up there. Yeah, there it is. So it should be online for everybody. I've set up the stage with CASPER and the rule that's at stake. I was asking if you could give a little bit of an explanation as to the precise claim that the power company was raising to say that the rule was invalid. And at this point, we are now within 2 minutes of the end of class, so I may do something really mean to you. How about I ask you to be the lead-off speaker on Tuesday? And we'll pick up this case. Let me add a few words about it for people to think about over the weekend. First of all, you can skim the DC Circuit opinion in the book. It's notable because it's a rare case of the DC Circuit energetically and actively striking down an entire EPA rule and vacating it ab initio. They really hated this rule. So it's notable in this case, the Supreme Court took cert and then reverse the DC Circuit. So I'll save you from having to tell me who wins. At the end of the day, EPA wins this case. The DC Circuit, an opinion by Ginsburg, if I remember correctly, basically comes to the rescue of EPA. The issue involved was essentially, again, this two-step process. Now for CASPER, the two-step process was, one, did a state contribute more than 1% to another state's downwind exceedances? It's not that one or two part per billion test from the earlier NOx-SIP call, it's a little different one. Sorry? You're thinking out loud?
Yeah.
Always dangerous. Okay, so that's step one. Step two is the same thing again. It's that cost technology threshold. So to a certain extent, there should be some deja vu here. The difference is CASPER is broader, more states, slightly different standards, vastly more complicated, and uses a FIP. And most importantly for our purposes, as of January 2015, is the law of the land. After remand back to DC Circuit and further fights, it's now what states are having to meet. So think about that. We'll talk a little bit more about why the court gave EPA the win, at, you know, took victory, took defeat from the jaws of victory for the DC Circuit. I'm trying to, it depends who you're representing there. Anyway, bottom line, did 180 degrees reversal. And with that, we'll wrap up clean air. If you have questions about clean air, bring them Tuesday. And then, I can't believe we're going to try and do this on Tuesday. We're going to try and do a one class session, Greenhouse Gas Permitting of the Clean Air Act, which is normally about a half semester of my clean air, my climate change law class. So be prepared, it may be a little fast that day, but it should be fun and interesting. Lots of cool stuff. Last chance, any other questions? Yeah. Let me see. I thought for the reading, yeah. So basically we're gonna do the climate change reading, which is gonna be the UARD case plus the textbook reading, and then the Homer City case that we've read for today on the website.